Your body is unique. So why would you settle for a weight loss plan that's one size fits all? Noom is the weight management program that takes into account your biology to build a custom plan just for you. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
I was the pudgy, milkless vice president of the family. Like they loved each other so much, and I was there too, you know, and like I was nothing. Like I didn't know what nothing meant until I became a dad. And then I was like, oh, that's what nothing is.
Hello and welcome to the Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. This is a fun episode. Hey, once again, once in a while, a fun episode. Mike Birbiglia is one of my favorite comedians, and he's, I think, almost more than a comedian. He's done these remarkable, beautiful movies like Sleepwalk With Me. He's done one-man shows. He's been on Broadway, written books. He's just terrific. I'm a big, big fan of his work. And he just wrote a book called The New One. And he was telling me about it, pitching me on it, I guess. And he was telling me that it was a book about fatherhood. And I sort of knew that because I'd seen his show here. It's on Netflix, his one-man show here, and seen him talking. Mike Birbiglia is somebody who did not intend to become a father, did not want to become a father, became a father. And it was really tough. Bonding was really tough. What it did to the marriage was really tough. And these are like foundational human things that a lot of people go through, and they're really hard to talk about. And so he sent me his book, and I read it in a day. I loved it. I loved how honest he was about something of incredible difficulty to be honest about. I love the way he wove through the poetry of his wife. He's just a beautiful, beautiful poet. In some ways, not in some ways, it's probably my favorite part of the book. And I was so excited to get to talk to him about it because I think about fatherhood all the time. I've had a different experience than him. But I think something that we both have noticed is that there's just very little discourse about it, very little examination of it, very little preparation from it. And if you're looking around when you're trying to become a father, or you are a father, or you're just a parent and trying to find something that helps help you structure how to think about it, there's actually less there than you'd expect. And much of what is there isn't very honest. Isn't very good, doesn't help you figure out the emotional dimension of what you're about to go through. So I'm not sure this episode will be for everybody, but I think it's a very fun conversation, even as it touches on deep and sometimes very dark themes. And I want it to be something, obviously, this is Mike and I talking about our experiences, which are very different from each other and will be very different from others. But I hope there's enough in here that's universal, that everybody can connect to it at least a little bit. As always, my email is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here, with great pleasure, is my conversation with Mike Birbiglia. Mike Birbiglia, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ezra. Love the podcast.
Thank you. You've got a lot going on. You got your own podcast. How does it feel to be the last comedian to get a podcast?
I had a podcast a couple of years ago called The Old Ones, and I really enjoyed doing it. But then I stopped doing it because it was slowing down my productivity as a writer. Cause I was fundamentally like, okay, this isn't helping me write. And what I am fundamentally at my core is a writer. So I stopped doing The Old Ones, even though I enjoyed doing it. And then with the pandemic, I came up with this concept, working it out, which is I work out my writing in real time with people like Ira Glass, John Mulaney, Hannah Gadsby, basically all these people who would be dream people for me to call and bounce ideas off of. And thereby, I'm actually not slowing my writing productivity. I'm just recording it and releasing it to the universe.
Is that actually working for you? Because something I have often had the intention to do this. I also think of myself as a writer at heart. I'm like, you know, my podcast is going to be a place where I work out ideas and articles. And then I find that the work of keeping the conversation moving means that when the podcast ends, I have absolutely no idea what happened in it. Like somehow it all occurred and people seem to enjoy the outcome, but I don't know what anybody said. And so if I ever want to find out, I have to go back and re-listen to the show.
I think you do. I think the re-listening is an essential component of the writing process, at least with my podcast. I do re-listen to them. You know, like I did this interview with Hannah Gadsby the other day where she said I was explaining a joke to her that I was working on about how I'm 42. The expression is over the hill, and I never understood the expression until I got on the hill and I looked around and I was like, oh, there's natural causes. They're not close, but they're coming. And then a bunch of other ruminations about aging. And she made this observation about being over the hill, which is that the walking down the other side of the hill is actually a completely different experience than the walking up of the hill. In other words, on the way up, you're cataloging all these things and tracking all these things. On the way down, you start to savor smaller things, the cup of coffee, the time, you know, the conversation with your wife about something specific. And it just becomes it's a completely different experience. And when she said that, I actually listened back to it because I was like, that I think that I should loop that into the ultimate show, which I'm writing.
And also on the way down, you're much likelier to hurt your knees and ankles, as I found. Yes. My regret, but also seems relevant to the process of aging.
That's right.
I've been wanting to start, because it all is happening in COVID, I've been wanting to start my show like by actually asking people where they, like, how are you? Like, how are you actually doing?
Sure.
Because I think people's emotional ranges are in different places than normal. Like, how are you today when I'm talking to you?
Pretty good today. I find that a lot of my happiness is based on, can I get outside and walk for about 40 minutes before noon, essentially? And a lot of that comes down to like childcare and me and Jen sort of, you know, asking Jen like, hey, do you mind if I go for this walk? And she is extraordinarily amenable to this part of me, which is like, if I don't walk early in the day, I get very, very depressed. And so that's a huge part of it. And then I feel pretty happy because last night, my wife and I are staying in Rhode Island right now because my brother and sister and their families live in Rhode Island. And we thought maybe we could see them in distance outdoors, right? And so yesterday we were able to, after hours, when it was very quiet, go to a beach and sort of distance and see them, and it was really quite joyous. So I today I'm good overall, Ezra. Like bad. if I'm being completely honest, bad. I mean, it's real. It's hard. Obviously, I'm in a position of privilege, and it's hard for me to say that because
I've had to do this on the show before. Let's agree that many people are worse off than we are. Like, let's premise that.
Yes.
And then also be able to talk about how people's lives are going.
Yes. So many people are struggling in so many worse ways. And so I'm so lucky. I have my wife and daughter. We have our health. I'd say my mental health is worse than it's been in 20 years.
Yeah, I hear that. I was thinking what you were saying about trying to go out for the walk in the morning. The thing that I didn't expect to be so hard about this is that it's clear I did not have any real understanding of the way spaces affect me and how I used them before. It was just natural. Yes,
that's right.
That like I had all these places to go for different things I needed.
Yep.
You know, one mood I would kind of naturally go out to a bookstore. Another mood I would go out to a coffee shop. Another mood I would go for a walk. Another need. And I don't even think I realized I was doing it. And now I will sometimes have this experience where I will feel terrible. Like terrible, like anger is a much nearer emotion for me than it normally is.
Mm-hmm.
And then I will, for whatever reason, go outside. Like I will go like see a friend in their backyard and all of a sudden I will feel fine. And it will turn out that whatever I was mad about was not the problem. I'm just getting very emotionally claustrophobic. There's some kind of physical interaction. And I found that really hard. Like, it's been sadder than I thought to lose my ability to like regulate myself through changing physical space.
Yeah. And I experienced that as well. And I think to write the book, essentially, I was journaling about things that were taboo, right? About the first year of having a child and sort of like feeling the things you're saying, anger and depression and this feelings of like feeling like, oh, I'm never going to be a part of this unit, which is my wife and my daughter. They have a special thing and I'm on the outside of that. And the journaling I did then ended up being this book, the new one. And then the journaling I'm doing right now, I think it'll end up being a book, but also just on its own merit. I always tell people this, people who aren't even writers, write in a journal, because usually by the end of it, if you write down the things you're most angry or upset about, by the end of it, if you read it back, you'll have some zoom out perspective on what's going on with yourself.
My wife just a couple weeks ago convinced me to start doing morning pages. Some people do it where the first thing in the morning, they write for 3 pages. I do it where I write for 12 minutes. And it really helps. And the idea is to write without judgment, which is hard for me. I don't know if you find this hard. It is hard for me as a writer to write in an authentic way where I'm not like, oh no, that's an unclear argument. That sentence doesn't follow. That's clunky.
Yep.
It's been a real to just try to let a more transparent relationship between me and the page emerge. But it has been helpful. But it's also, I don't know if you felt this looking back at your journals from that first year. It's also been sad, right? I keep thinking about how this is one of my, you know, things go well, 80 years of life on this earth. And there are a lot of amazing things in it. I mean, you know, my son is great and a lot of things are going well. But man, the number of them that just begin not feeling great today is just like, I'm starting to recognize it as a real problem, given that this is going to go on for who knows how long, but you can't just lose a year to this. You got to figure something out.
I think that's right. And I think for me, it was the podcast, because it was figuring out a way that I can have a job, which is creating a podcast, and then also continue to write and collaborate with peers in a way that makes me feel okay. But I agree with you. It's not easy. Everyone has to figure out how to make it not a lost year.
I will say this, and I'm not bullshitting. One of the periods of joy, you sent me your book. You said I was going to enjoy reading it. We don't know each other well. I've just kind of Twittered back and forth once or twice. And I loved it. It was like 4 hours of really, really, I sat outside and I read it and like kept reading it right through to it being finished. And it was great. But I was beginning to say before we started that you're very far, I'm sorry, from the best part of it. The really great part of your book is I've been trying to appreciate poetry more, and your book is shot through with your wife's poems about young parenthood. And in some ways, I actually connected more to her side of it a little bit than yours, but some of her poems just I can't get out of my head. Like, she has one about the toddler's clock of now, and I have a toddler now, and the clock of now is a clock where all of the numbers just have the word now.
That's right.
I think about it 76 times a day.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's a beautiful poem. I mean, one of the challenges of this book was that it's my wife Jen's poetry and my prose. And one of the challenges was that I would have in a Word document her poem that was matching my prose, and I would read her poem and just go, this is not nearly as good as that poem. It made it very intimidating, very hard to do. But it's ultimately, I'm so glad that you connected with that, because, you know, one of the things I learned from collaborating with my wife is that, you know, she wrote under a pseudonym for years and years and years, 10, 15 years, whatever. And until I coaxed her into writing this book publicly with me, really was going to just do that and be anonymous, and the quality and the of her work is so extraordinary. And it's just you know what it makes me think that there are just thousands and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not millions of writers in the world secretly writing stuff in their morning pages that are better than anything being published.
You know, there was just in my world of journalism and stuff, a fight over this blogger, Scott Alexander, who writes under a pseudonym at a place called Slate Star Codex. And the New York Times was going to profile him and they were going to use his real name. And he didn't want that. And I don't know by the time this comes out how that will be resolved. I hope they didn't use his name because he has a life he wants to protect. But something I've been thinking about around that, and I wonder about it with you persuading your wife to write under her own name, is the more my name has become something that matters in my work, which is to say a name that some people know and have associations with, the more joy has drained out of my writing.
Oh my gosh.
And there's a real freedom to writing under a pseudonym. So I'm curious if you think you actually did your wife a favor by persuading her to write under her name, because I do think there's something to being able to write, and it's not you, it's the writing. You're not trying to protect your ego. You're not trying to change the way people relate to you in the world. You're just trying to say what it is you really think.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think there's so much joy in anonymity. I convinced Jen to start an Instagram feed at J Hope Stein where she posts poems and these sort of multimedia pieces. And I think she's just doing it for me. I was like, we have a book. It's public. It's out in the world. We have to tell people that we exist, you know? And I really genuinely think like when she does her requisite, like 30 posts, I don't know if she'll ever do it again.
Since we're talking about it, do you have it in front of you, the toddler clock of now?
I do. It's in the chapter called Slice of Life, which is all about my addiction to pizza. And it's called the Now Clock. The now clock is the clock of a toddler in which every number is replaced by the word now, and the hands of the now are always pointed directly at the now or between two nows.
It's so great.
So isn't it beautiful?
I spent a number of hours over the past couple of weeks living in the first, in the period of your wife's pregnancy, and then in the first, I guess, year or two of your daughter's life. How old is your daughter now? Just so I know where we really are in time.
She just turned 5. It's always very confusing for people because this was a Broadway show 2 years ago, and now it's a book. And so people always think she's 13 months old. She's suspended in time at 13 months old. But no, it's about the pregnancy and the first 13 months of my daughter's life. And it sort of ends there because that was a turning point for me where I realized that there was a way for me to be a member of the new family unit, or, you know, the new one, which is the title.
Just so I know where you are, how is fatherhood for you now compared to then?
The now clock. it's wonderful. I think 5 years old. And then, you know, once you start telling people this, they go, oh, yeah, yeah. And then, of course, no one had told you this before. But 5 years old is a spectacular age because she's curious. She wants to learn to swim. She wants to learn to read. She'll improvise stories with me. She'll, you know, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, in her, you know, the joy of seeing her play with her cousins makes me so happy. I mean, they're honestly, and what I chalk it up to, and it makes me feel like kind of an idiot saying this or admitting this, around 13 months is when she became very verbal. And then from that point on, I felt like I could connect with her because I'm very verbal. And it's genuinely embarrassing to admit that because, of course, as a dad, it shouldn't take your baby becoming verbal for you to be able to connect with them. But it did.
Oh, that's so interesting. You know, that's funny because it's one of my questions for you, which is the book is so much about the difficulties of the pregnancy. And then you had an experience, which a lot of fathers have, and which scared me a lot becoming a father, where you had a lot of trouble bonding in that first year. And it sort of constructed the book as a redemption story, but the redemption happens very quickly at the end, the, like,
yes,
collapsing into a unit where now you feel on the inside. It happens all at once where, like, I've spent a lot of time in the difficulties you have. And it was never actually quite clear to me what had changed, but that's what changed, the ability to speak and to interact in that way.
Yeah. Like there's a couple moments where, you know, we're eating pizza together and she goes, pee pee, which means pizza. And yeah, I'll read you the beginning of this chapter, sort of a It's called Slice of Life. And one day I take Una to Sal's Pizza on our corner. I order two slices and we sit at a table and eat. She's thrilled. I say, Una, do you like the pizza? She says, pee-pee, which I'm pretty sure means pizza, and also yes. When we finish our slices, she says, pee-pee. She wants more pizza, and also yes. I'm not quite sure what to do. Her mom said one slice, but she didn't say anything about two slices. How much pizza can a one-year-old eat? The battle cry grows stronger. Pee-pee! I can see this look in her eye that I recognize. She wants more pizza, and she wants it now. And there's a few of those in the final chapters of the book where that's, for me, it was in some ways as simple as that, as I was able to start connecting with her verbally, and I feel really silly saying that that's part of it, but that was part of it.
Support for the Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger, or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been Podcast Futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/gray area. That's greenlight.com/gray area to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/gray area.
So I've been thinking about how to have this conversation because, one, I was so excited for somebody to want to come on the show, people want to listen to talk about fatherhood, because it's like most of what I think about now, but obviously it's not the main part of my job. But also that you had a very different experience of the first year, and I always felt totally unprepared for the first year. And so I sort of want to talk about the things that I feel like I couldn't find anyone saying anything about. And in particular, I want to talk about this like question of how do you bond with your kid?
Sure.
Because, so to just give you a little bit of a sense of our story here, my son was born 6 weeks early. We had a really, really medically hard pregnancy, and then a really scary birth. And then we spent 3 weeks in the NICU. And it was all of that was unbelievably hard and traumatic. He's completely great in every way, and he's a giant and talking, like everything's great now. So no need to worry. But that was all really hard. But one thing that happened along the way is that from the beginning, because he was too small to breastfeed, so we did a lot of bottle feeding right at the beginning. Because we were in the NICU where there was actually a lot of hands-on help from nurses, Everything that my wife could do, I could do as well.
Oh, wow.
That would change over time as he got stronger.
Yeah.
But I was able to like do every act of care.
Mm-hmm.
And something I was thinking about reading your book was that there were a lot of things that wasn't true for you because of your sleep condition. You had to sleep in another room.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't do as much of the night work as that was real bonding time for us.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That it seems like your partner breastfed. So that's a real thing where you don't get to do that part. And I feel like one of the hard things for dads in that first year, a lot of time is particularly if your partner breastfeeds, your kid can't talk to you. So the only way to establish a relationship is through acts of care. But if all you're doing is washing bottles and changing diapers, it becomes hard. And then you get into a cycle where the mom knows the kid better. And that seems really hard. And I feel like it's something they don't tell dads to expect or try to work against.
Yeah, I think I say in the book, I felt, I was the pudgy, milkless vice president of the family. They loved each other so much. And I was there too. And I was nothing. I didn't know what nothing meant until I became a dad. And then I was oh, that's what nothing is. And I'll tell you something interesting about performing this show in whatever it was, 40, 50 cities and on Broadway for 100 performances is that a lot of dads come up to me and they say, that's exactly what I experienced. But then an equal amount of moms come up to you and say, that was my exact experience. And so I actually don't even think my experience was 100% specific to being a dad. I think that there's a degree to which some parents, they bond immediately with the baby. And there's some who bond at 6 weeks or 6 months or a year. And honestly, Ezra, I don't think people talk about it. The reason I wrote the book was because when I was experiencing it, this thing of not connecting, I was looking around for who else has written about this. Who can I learn from? Nobody was saying. Can I curse on the podcast? I don't know.
Yeah, please.
No one fucking says anything about this.
Don't you not curse? Isn't that your thing?
No, it's not.
Have I just broken Mike Birbiglia?
Yeah. I'm so angry. No, it's I curse minimally. Is the truth. I mean, I'm not like Jim Gaffigan or Jerry Seinfeld, where I have I never curse. But I find it to be typically I don't curse a lot on stage because I find it to be not the best word choice. Until it is, essentially. And so I find it's used excessively by comedians in a way that I don't do as much. And so, and then, of course, whenever my stuff is on public radio, there's no cursing on it. So if I'm on This American Life telling a story, there's no cursing. But anyway, I was fucking mad, is what I'm saying, that there wasn't anything about this feeling of oh my gosh, what if I never truly connect or bond with my child, and how scary that was. And so I wrote the book with, honestly, I had no intention of writing about having children. To be honest with you, everyone comes up to me, they go, oh, your daughter's 5. You're going to write a book about what it's like to have a 5-year-old. And I go, no, I'm writing my next book is about my own death, because that's what I think about all the time because I'm in middle age. but I really don't want to talk about having a child again. I feel like this is what I have to say about it. This is a novel thing that I haven't seen written about. That's why I wrote it.
It's, the place where I found a lot of this was online, was Reddit. Before we had a kid, I used to spend a lot of time on Reddit dad forums, and there's a lot of stuff there about not bonding, but it's also a really scary place. It's not I guess Reddit can be a scary place, but it's it's a little bit I found searching for information as a expectant dad or as a new dad to be a little bit like Googling health symptoms where everything is cancer.
Yep.
I went one night to Google. And I don't remember what I was trying to find, but it was something about sleeping. But so my sentence began, I'm a dad and. And what it was I'm a dad and I hate my child. I'm a dad and I want to leave. I'm a dad and I want a divorce. I'm like, oh my God. And it's funny because on the one hand, you say that there's not a lot of conversation about this experience of being a dad. And on the other hand, my experience was that there wasn't a lot of positive conversation about it either. I went and I gathered a lot of the dad literature I could find. And no offense to people who've written that literature, it was bad. It was thin. It was bad. There's like a couple interesting things. Michael Lewis wrote a book at one point.
Yes, he did.
I think it was a little thin, but it came from his Slate columns. But it's a little bit about this. Like, he's trying to explore that same question. He says at the beginning of, how do I go at the beginning from like sort of wanting to protect this thing to being willing to jump into traffic for it?
Yep.
And he's tracing that. But it's, I like wanted that book to be five times as long or something. And there just isn't that much. There's a lot of, I would call it bro dad literature. Like, like, you're going to be a dad, bro. And like, like, it's going to suck, but like, not all parts of it are good. It's like a very insulting discourse. It's weird. Like,
I'll tell you something.
The conversation about fatherhood is just sort of weird and thin.
Well, I'll try to sell some books for you, because God knows we need to move some of your books. It's a polarization. It's a polarization issue. it really is. I actually truly mean this. There's a polarization when it comes to discussing children, and the polarization is, there's either a saccharine, you're going to love your baby, and it's so beautiful, and it's the most beautiful thing you've ever experienced, and you're seeing the world through baby's eyes. And then there's the other end of the polarization, which is, fuck these kids, they're going to fucking take my money and fucking blah, blah, blah. And it's like, literally, there's nothing in between, in my experience. And that's why part of the reason I wrote this book, is part of the reason I wrote the Broadway show, is that I was like, no, I want to tell my story, which is actually it's dead center in between those two experiences. It is a very special experience having a child. And it is also very lonesome sometimes. And I just felt like that hadn't been written. And to be honest with you, I don't know if this happens in politics as well, to speak to what your book is about, but like, what I found is, in general, the book and the show really connect with people, but there is a small contingent of people who get very upset when they pick something up that they think is going to be the saccharine I had a child book, and then it's not.
I could totally buy that. I mean, that definitely happens in politics, 100%.
I think people get truly, truly upset. There's a line in the show and in the book where I say, you know, at my rock bottom moment, I had this thought, and that thought was, I get why dads leave. And first of all, actions speak louder than words. I didn't leave. I'm not going to leave. And I say that in the show and in the book. But even having that thought and putting it into the universe was really upsetting for some people. And I get why, but also I'm glad I put it out there, because it wasn't out there in anything I'd read.
I wonder how many of the people it's really upsetting for, to the extent their parents, it's like scratching a little too deep.
Yeah, you know, of course. I mean, and it's so sad. Comedy is, the thing about comedy, comedy since I entered the profession 20 years ago, went from being sort of an indie art form to being popular, to the detriment of the art form of comedy. Because I think that when you say things in a comedy setting right now, people go, I don't like that you're saying that, but you know what? Maybe it wasn't for you. You know, like 20 years ago, you wouldn't have ever picked up a comedy book or seen a comedy show. So maybe it's not for you. I don't know.
It's all such a weird, I don't know, parenthood is a weird discourse. And I think probably weirder now that we don't have like big multi-generational families, like, to be my political self about it. I bet it was really different becoming a parent in a culture where there were lots of kids around all the time. But for a lot of folks now, it's like, if you moved away from home, from the place you grew up, and you waited into your, say, 30s to have kids, and you're not in a community where there's like big multi-generational families, you're going into something you don't see. And so it's like, maybe there didn't need to be as big literature, because there's this constant lived experience. You had it, and the people around you have it. But now there's not. Something I think about all the time from that period is, when people talk to me about it, it's very easy, and I still feel this when I talk to others, I can really explain what I lost, right? If you don't have a kid, I can really explain it, right? Like, my being tired feels a lot like you're being, not literally you're being tired because you might jump out a window, but most people's being tired. Mm-hmm. And my, like, not having enough time for work or for myself or for my partner or, you know, not having agency over my time, all that stuff feels more or less the way you would expect. And I'm not somebody who thinks like parenthood is easy or purely beautiful or anything else. And on the other hand, the things I gained, I couldn't have quite explained.
Yeah,
and certainly weren't explained to me. Like, I like my son more than I thought I would. I thought I would love my kid, not like them.
Yes, yes. And I completely relate to that, by the way.
Isn't that a weird feeling? Like, I was like, crazy. Oh, I knew I'd want to protect you, but you seem great.
No, absolutely.
But the end of that is simply that one of the reasons I think that's bad is not like just to make the point about the asymmetry, but that I think if somebody had told me or had been able to convey, or there was more literature about the like what the good parts are, not that it would have changed my decision about when to do it or whether to do it, but maybe I would have understood a little bit better what I'm trying to build. You know, like what yeah. where I'm trying to put my energy, like what it means for me to be a good dad. I felt like there was a lot of like how to not let your kid die in the crib, but not yes. a lot of how to like build a good relationship with your son. And I just how, given how ubiquitous the experience is, it's just genuinely weird to me.
Yeah, you were talking in one of your interviews on this podcast recently about how becoming a parent is an unexplainable, impossible to explain experience. And the best way that I can describe it to people who haven't had kids is that it doesn't, if you had a kid, it doesn't mean you're better, doesn't mean you know more, doesn't mean whatever, but there is, there's a superiority that some parents have over people who don't have kids, because there's an aperture opening that occurs where, and some people describe it as like your heart getting bigger or your aperture opening, where you see things in a way that you literally couldn't see them before. And the joke I make in the book is at the beginning of the book, I'm so annoyed by these parents who are like, you have to have a kid. It's the best. You see the world through baby's eyes. And I'm just like these losers telling me I'm going to see the world through baby's eyes. And then at the end of the book, I'm basically, you know, it's spoiler alert. It's like, I'm seeing the world through baby's eyes. Like, you really do become the cliche. And it's nearly impossible to explain.
I totally don't see the world through my kids' eyes.
Really? Oh, really?
I don't think I do at all. Sometimes I see, in the sense that it's like everything is gray except something that is sharp or could be lit on fire or climbed. Like, I have developed this sort of like danger vision that he seems to have in a more positive sense.
Yes.
But I feel more, I don't even know if I want to say this, I feel more like myself than I thought I would. before, okay. Right? I thought I would change in certain ways more before.
Yeah.
But like that a relationship deeper than any other is now in my life. Like it's almost more like marriage or something than anything else. That I don't really identify so much with like parent culture exactly. Although clearly I've been trying to find books on it. But that I just sort of identify like as I'm in this one relationship and it's very, very intense and yes. it like really reorders my world. And there's something kind of cool about, or it can be cool, some days it's very frustrating, about not being the center of your own world anymore. There yes. are a lot of days where I sort of wish I didn't have to take the morning shift.
Yeah, and then, sure.
On the other end of it, I'm like, I'm really glad I was there. I'm just not just sitting here staring at my computer. Like, I'm not as good a judge sometimes as what would make for a nice day as my very angry until he gets out of the house toddler is.
Yes. I was going to read you a thing because I was going to essentially paraphrase something off the top of my head. And then I was like, actually, there is a passage about this, which is, at the hospital, I describe, you know, at a certain point, you know, they hand you this monkey and you're like, but we're humans. And they're like, this is what it is. And then you're like, can we speak with a manager? And they're like, there isn't one. And you're like, that's the problem. And I say, this is what relates to what we were just talking about. I'm not immediately in love with our monkey. I'm committed to our monkey. I start trying to figure out how to finance our life with the monkey for the next 20 years. If someone tried to take the monkey, I would have punched that person until they killed me. But I'm not attached to the monkey. I'd like to tell you I was. Some people are, and some people aren't. And the ones who aren't generally don't tell you they aren't. I would do anything for our baby monkey, but it doesn't mean I understand our baby monkey. And that's sort of how I feel about the first couple of years, is like this thing of, I'm wildly defensive of our child, but I don't understand it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. By the way, I just want to tell you, I loved in that section of your book, and you said it here too, I would have punched them until they killed me. Just
Very of course,
line.
I would lose, of course, in the battle, I would lose, but I would try.
Yeah, I mean, you try. That's like the key thing. I find the dance of chemicals in the brain on this really, I don't know if I want to say amazing or infuriating. Because you just realize what a mark you are for your own brain chemistry. So the thing that is the weirdest thing of everything about being a parent to me is the things my son is doing are, I would say, like, objectively not that impressive.
Sure.
He's walking. Most people walk.
Right.
He has developed the capacity to name objects in his world, as do most people. I mean, like, the things he's doing are... It would be really, like, terrible
unremarkable.
If they weren't
they're
working
unremarkable.
Out.
Yeah.
You know, they're unremarkable.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting here following human excellence yet, you know? And yet my level of intense, the joy and following and did you see and, like, where are your teeth? And there's this, it is to me, like, the weirdest, most profound thing about parenting, the way it invests so much magic in the banal. Right. The way you're going through literally the most generic experience a human being can go through. Like, you went through it, your parents went through it, their parents. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't be here if everybody hadn't done it up until this moment.
Yeah.
And yet it is like the most vivid, intense, amazing thing of your life. The only thing I sometimes analogize it to is like, if you explained a day on a psychedelic to somebody, like, I sat there and stared at a tree, they'd be like, that doesn't sound very interesting. Be like, no, but this tree, and in this context, and the way I was thinking about it, it was like an amazing day. And it has some of that, where it's like, you're not doing anything from the outside all that interesting. But to you, like, whatever's going on in your brain, it is just the most profound, intense journey that you've, like, ever seen a creature conduct.
Ezra, I don't want to tell you your life, but you're seeing the world through baby's eyes.
Damn it. Maybe you're right. Maybe
you're literally just rephrasing the cliche. You think you're being clever and intellectual. You're just saying, I'm seeing the world through
just
baby's
rephrasing
eyes.
The cliche.
Yeah.
That is, I will say, that is the most self-annihilating part of parenthood, is realizing every other parent was right about everything.
That's right.
All the things where you're like, I'm not going to be an uncool parent moving out to have a backyard. And like, you know, like, nope. They were right about it. They were like, all those parents are like, I can't do anything between 12 and 10 p.m. at night because of nap time. And you're like, come on, it's just nap time. It's like, nope, they were right.
One of the things when Jen and I were deciding to have a child, she really did say, and it's in the book, but she said, this baby isn't going to change the way we live our lives. And I said, of course it will. It fundamentally will change the way we live our lives. It's the definition of what having a child is. And she insisted that was true. And of course, it's, you know, everything's flipped upside down. If people watch the Netflix version of this special, there's a point in the show, and it's a spoiler again, but where after we have the child, all of these hundreds, if not thousands of toys fall from the ceiling of this Broadway theater at the Court. And for the rest of the show, I'm walking through all this crap, toys and diapers and crap. And that's, I can't tell you how many parents came up to me and said, the toys on the stage, that's been our life for the last 3 years. It's exactly what our life is like.
Yeah. Yeah. And he does, and he doesn't even care about him. That's the killer.
Right, exactly.
My whole house is filled with bright plastic crap, and all he wants to do is bang metal implements into cookware.
No, I know. I mean, my friend Ben said to me when our daughter had just been born, he said, you know, you'll buy them all kinds of stuff, and what they really want to play with is a cardboard box.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com. Most weight loss programs focus on restriction and inflexible routine, which is why most diets fail. But Noom isn't a diet. It's a weight management program that uses psychology and biology to help you develop healthy, sustainable habits. Noom believes that weight loss starts with the brain, and their daily lessons are tailored to help users understand the science behind food cravings and eating choices. Whether you want to lose weight, increase physical activity, meet a health goal, or simply change the way you think about food, Noom can help you build healthy habits while still enjoying your favorite foods. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com and check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Tell me a bit about the writing you did in this book about what having a kid did to your marriage for the first year. Because that is, I think, a tough part of all this. And it's one that I think is scary to anybody who goes into it. And I felt as a reader that I was stunned by some of the things you were actually admitting. And then at the end, you talk about how hard it was even to have these conversations about the book with your partner. So I guess my question on this is like, how did you come up with even like the willingness to have the conversations to put these things in a book with your partner?
Well, all of it was stuff that I'd written in private journals, and a lot of Jen's poetry was stuff that she had written privately in her notebooks. And it was, I think it was a year and a half in when we were at a film festival, and the festival asked me if I would tell a story. In the story, the theme was jealousy. And I said, no, I don't think I'm going to tell a story. And Jen said, you're jealous of our daughter, Una. You should talk about that. And in some ways, it was like a challenge. It was like, I was like, really? You want me to talk about that? Because I'll talk about that. And I have some thoughts. And so that week, Jen and I...
I've prepared an hour and a half.
Yeah, yes. And that week, Jen and I sort of talked out what I had written in my notebook, and she shared some poems with me, and I shared some jokes with her, and then I told a story at that storytelling night, and really it got a lot of laughs. I mean, it had the line, which is, I love my wife and daughter love each other so much, and I'm there too, you know, and that was really the incarnation of the whole show and the whole book. And to be honest with you, like, it was every step of the way in writing this book was, it was challenging to have these conversations, because it was like going to couples therapy, except there's no therapist. You know, it's just like, there's no arbiter of truth. And one of the themes of the book is that there's two very different sides of the same story. And that's actually a piece of advice I give to all married couples, regardless of whether you're having a child, is that I would say one piece of advice is always you have to accept in marriage that you are two people who are witnessing nearly identical events at the same time and will have completely different memories of those same events. And that's hard, you know, that's a hard thing to negotiate, which is why I feel very lucky to have found my life partner in Jen, someone who is willing to crack that stuff wide open and who understands that flaws are part of what make us unique as opposed to deal breakers in marriage.
I was thinking when I read that those parts of the book about something in Lost in Translation, the movie.
Sure, we love that one.
Where it's so good. It's one of those movies that I will watch whenever I am not feeling great.
Yeah,
it has that quality for me.
It's really special.
And at some point, Bill Murray's talking to Scarlett Johansson's character, and she's like, "Tell me about being a parent." And he says, and I'm paraphrasing here from memory, that, "Oh, it's amazing. They grow up into these like amazing people." And then she's like, and how about marriage? How does that? And he's like, well, that's harder.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I was like, thought that was like this really sad. And this is not like a reflection on mine. Like my wife and I are happy. But there is something that seems really unfair in that kind of first year, which is that you have all this like chemical protection in your relationship with the baby, but it does not extend to your relationship with the partner. And like everybody I know has had kids. It's not always hard on the marriage, but it often is. And like there's research on this that marital happiness goes down. And here's another place where I don't feel like people are given a lot of good constructive advice about what to do aside from, you know, try to keep things clean. But it's a trickier part of this that I think requires like work. And it's one thing I really appreciated about the book that I felt that you had a particularly rough go of that. But I think just warning people that something that needs a lot of attention is really important.
Yeah, I sometimes say and sometimes in jest, and sometimes I'm not sure it's in jest, is that in some ways you should choose after a child is born whether or not you're going to get married again and go to City Hall like we did on our first time and get married again and renew your vows. Because it's a different marriage, and it's just a different relationship. And that's part of the reason why the book and the show was called The New One, because it's really about change and how I asked my brother at one point, I say, "Joe, you know, what is it like being a parent?" And he says, "It's not better or worse. It's just new." And that was where the title came from, The New One, which is the new baby, the new life, the new marriage, the new consciousness. It's everything about it is new. And if you have this sense of it's not going to be that, I think therein lie a lot of the challenges.
What advice would you give to somebody who came to you now and was going to have a kid or, you know, was having a kid and like wanted to be a good husband during it? I mean, you've had this experience. Are there things you wished you had done differently or things that you feel somebody would have told you it would have helped?
I think this is for any parent, I would say, is if you're in a partnership or a marriage of any kind, is always do more than you think you should. Always do more dishes. Always sweep the floor more. Always do more laundry, always, you know, change more diapers, like anything that you think will help, do more of it, because you'll never regret doing more for your partner. And that's where I fucked up. that's why this is a cautionary tale. This is definitely not a manual for having a child. It is a cautionary tale. It's a cautionary tale about how not to be a parent.
Yeah, that question of, this is one of those things that I think feels obvious, but then you live it. You've got a routine about how to keep your space in reasonable order and how to keep like everybody's energy in reasonable order. And that really goes away. And then it changes a lot, right? I mean, sleeping habits change and, you know, at some point they begin walking around and their main activity is taking everything out of every place it is and putting it on the floor.
Sure.
Or into some new place you don't expect. And your systems aren't built for that.
Yeah.
Your chore wheel isn't built for that.
Yeah.
Like that is one thing that, so, you know, I have like had to become like much more sensitized to. You just like have to give not just the parenting, I don't want to say it's the easy part, but it's a little bit in some ways more straightforward, in part because your kid screams at you if you're doing a bad job at it. Whereas like the other things, like you, like they need attention because they don't shout, but they do build up a lot of frustration, or all of a sudden everybody's mad and you realize it's because the house is in terrible disarray.
Right.
Like, I feel like there should just be like books about how to, like, maybe there are. There should be more help on how to manage all those parts of it because they're more important than one would expect. And I feel like, again, like back when people lived in bigger multi-kin families, probably that all just got redistributed. But when it's just you and your partner, it's really just on you. And that's pretty new. And we have pretty high cleanliness standards in the modern world.
Sure.
And often two jobs in the house, and it's tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was talking to Hasan Minhaj about this the other day, who has two children, and he said that we have like in Indian culture, this is true too, like with his parents, like we have this like sort of perfection cultural in America and India, et cetera, like this perfection complex of everything needs to be clean and perfect and shiny. And in some ways, that's what comedy is for, is basically to say, actually, no, everything's going to be really fucked up and that's okay.
I like that a lot, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's always one of those things too, right? How do you begin to live with different standards than you did before, which is a good thing to have an explicit conversation about, I would say. But it is all just different. It is why I really like the title, the new one. Something that comes up in the book a bit, which I was curious about, is you very much describe yourself as a workaholic in the book. It's kind of clear that at some point you figured out that you could do this amazing job and you could do it well. But I think people who find that out a little bit later in life, there's a real desperation to how they cling to it. I've been to that, I think, myself, or maybe I'm reading myself into you. Kids are not great for that. Those two things don't coexist super well. How has having a kid changed your relationship with your work or your work identity?
I used to travel to sometimes 100 cities in a year. I've been everywhere. I think I make a joke in the book, which is I've performed in some places that aren't even towns. They're just an Applebee's with a dream. And it's like I go everywhere. And I at a certain point, I just, when Una was born, I just decided I'm not going to go to 100 cities. I might go to 20 cities. I might go to 15 cities, that kind of thing. And so that's changed a lot. I've sort of like, you know, I had the show run off Broadway and on Broadway in New York, which is near home. And that was, that was just a huge life transition. But yeah, I agree with you. I think the workaholism is like a thing that is possibly just a crutch too. Like, I don't know. What happened, I think, is my dad was a doctor. He's a neurologist. And he really put so much emphasis in my family. I'm youngest of four, on education and our professions. And so he was definitely a workaholic. He wasn't around a lot. And he's a really good doctor. And so when I got out of, you know, Georgetown and said, I'm going to move to New York City and be a professional stand-up comedian. I mean, to say that he was disapproving would be the understatement of the century. Like, he really sort of disowned me. I mean, he didn't say the word disown, but it was unspoken that was not going to be an acceptable thing if I wanted to come home for Christmas. And so I had this pressure to succeed so quickly, and everything that I was doing, which was essentially like booking myself at comedy clubs by cold calling the comedy club lines and saying, hey, I'm a comedian and here's, I'll send you my tape and blah, blah, blah. I was basically like a full-time traveling salesman, telemarketer and comedian all at once. I slept probably 7 hours a day and then worked the rest of my waking hours. And that's how I came up. That's what I was trained on. And I think like a lot of millennials now, there's like this big conversation about workaholism versus, you know, so I think some millennials go like, would say to me, and maybe rightfully so, by the way, they'd go, well, that's your choice. You do you. I'm going to work healthy hours and have a healthy life. and it's hard because when I hear that argument, I'm like, yeah, that's not wrong. I don't know. That's just sort of how I came up.
That's so, yeah. I'm trying to think about that for a minute. Because there's also this whole conversation about millennials is like the burnout generation. The thing in there that I kind of see in my own life is, and the thing that has always been tricky for me with parenthood is I just got really used to measuring my own value by how much work I got done in a day.
Yeah.
Like it's sort of like how I justified my existence here for a day.
Yeah.
And you're going to get less work done. Like that is a true fact. Yeah. Michael Chabon actually has a really nice book about fatherhood. And he talks about this about Michael Chabon, the author. And he talks about, I should have mentioned his book earlier.
Manhood for Amateurs, right?
Yeah. And it's just, it's great actually. And
I read that. I think it's fantastic.
And he talks about an older novelist telling him that for every child you have, that's one fewer book. That's one less book you're going to write. Books.
Yes.
One fewer books you're going to
yes.
write. And him just saying like, yeah, okay. Like that's like, this seems okay. It's a reasonable trade-off. But it is like, that is again, like a hard thing to begin to transition. I mean, I work weekends. Like it's not healthy. And so
sure.
traditionally it's not been healthy. And transitioning over to like, it was a good day because I spent it, you know, like being a parent and then resting. I mean, oh, that's the other fucking thing. The one, maybe you can tell me how to fix this because like I am still struggling here. I used to burn myself out on the week.
Mm-hmm.
I may do a bit of work on the weekends, but you can rest some of the weekends. The end of weekends is a time when I can rest.
Yeah.
I have not figured that out at all. Like I just don't know where to put resting.
I wrote a bit about this the other day and it's, and it'll be on my podcast soon, but it's, I remember a few weeks ago, it was a Saturday and I'd worked all week and I was quote unquote off. And then I realized when you have kids, there is no off. There's only on and more on and off.
It's more on
yeah. than on. When you're off, you think, oh man, I wish I had more time on. Because you can't tell your 5-year-old daughter, I'd love to get you a Band-Aid for your boo-boo, but I'm off. And even the term off is misleading because when you're off, you're still alive. I mean, actual off is dead. Like I read in the newspaper, a guy jumped off a bridge. He's off. If you're alive, you're on. And in Buddhism, when you try to turn off and you try to think nothing. And for me, it never works. I fall asleep, which for me is on. Because I sleepwalk, but that was what I wrote. I literally wrote that almost identical thing the other day. And in the pandemic, of course, it's completely heightened because you're not going to work. You're home, which you're on.
Yeah, that is the part of this. I'd be curious to hear how pandemic has affected you in this. I think I'm a lot sadder about it because I'm a parent.
Yeah.
Like I would have been sad about it anyway. It would have been horrible, but. I don't know. My kid should be able to go to a playground and like play with other children. I'm supposed to be able to take him to a bookstore and like let him pull out books and look at them. I'm supposed to be able to take him around other people.
Yeah.
And I can explain to myself why I can't do any of that and that I may at some point be able to. But we walk in our neighborhood, like past a playground that is gated up and there's a padlock.
Yeah.
I mean, understandably, right? I mean, they're closed.
Of course.
But it's sad on a million levels and like people are dying and they've lost their jobs. And I mean, there's tragedy ripping across the country.
Yes.
But there's also just this like poignancy to not being able to explain to somebody who is just learning what other people are.
I think that's absolutely true.
You are supposed to be able to go near them, just not right now.
No, I mean, Jen and I lament this constantly, and it's part of the reason that we came out to Rhode Island is we got this little Airbnb that has a backyard, basically, and because we want Una to be able to run around, and we got like a slip and slide, you know, like we're just doing anything we can to give some sense of, like, you know, the joys of nature and summer and her cousins, and we try to take her to the beach, all this stuff. But I will say, like, I should plug this thing that Jen and I are doing. We're doing a virtual bookstore tour in August of local bookstores, because you're saying this thing of like that you'd like to be able to take your son to a bookstore. And it's like, we really do have to protect, you know, our bookstores, our pizzerias, like all of these, our restaurants, our places that are not protected in the pandemic. And I mean, there have been articles written about this, but I think you can't emphasize this enough. Some of these places will not make it through the pandemic. On, you know, comedy clubs, I did a whole, I raised a lot of money for wait staffs at comedy clubs across America called Tip Your Wait Staff. And we helped with all these GoFundMe pages raise about $600,000. And we're still, if people want to contribute, there's a site called tipyourwaitstaff.com. And there's a map where you can find the local comedy club. It, you know, all these places that we take for granted that are small businesses may not exist if we don't support them right now. And bookstores is a prime example. I mean, Books Are Magic in my neighborhood in Brooklyn is one of our favorite places to be with Una on the face of the earth.
Are there things that you have found to do with her that you think if we were not in a pandemic, you wouldn't have discovered, but you're happy you did?
I think that one of the things, we're city people, we live in Brooklyn. And so one of the things that's been kind of awesome is like, you know, we have a backyard, and once again, Ezra, we're seeing the world through baby's eyes, having a backyard with rocks and bugs and rabbits and all these things it's very special, you know, and she sees a couple rabbits in a day. She goes nuts, you know, and she collects rocks and, you know, all these things that are in a city are harder to come by.
Yeah, I've had a little bit of that too. I mean, I guess, okay, fair enough. Seeing the world through baby's eyes. I had a thought not long ago when I realized like how nuts my son went outside, like just like how much he was, how happy he always was to be outside. And like, I've been a city person for a long time, lived in DC for 15 years and live in the Bay Area now. And just realizing that I wanted him to be able to be around trees.
Yeah.
Like that had not been something I would have thought about before, because I like trees just fine, but don't think about them very often. But like, he clearly does, or animals or whatever. That there's some like very obvious connections between kids and nature. Like they're clearly tuned to pay attention.
Sure.
Like my son's first word was doggy. Like he just shouts doggy all the time.
Yeah.
And like still, now he's got a lot of words, but like doggies remains our favorite word all the time. Like from the first moment we wake up to the moment we go to bed. And it's very cute, but there's also clearly something in him that is like more interested in animals than people.
Yeah.
And there's like a funny thing where human beings are very adaptable. All my favorite parenting literature is by Alison Gopnik.
Oh, who's
been on the show before, and she's a philosopher and child research scientist, and she's great. But I've been reading her book, The Philosophical Baby, and she talks about how the fundamental thing about the human mind and the child's mind particularly is how open it is to changing. So you can like change kids out of that. But there's very clearly, looking back as somebody who has probably been changed out of that somewhat, like there's clearly like an expectation that will be there, right? That's like where they start. And like you can teach them that, oh, like, you know, we don't live around animals. Animals are food. Don't worry about it.
Sure.
But if you don't go in that direction, like they're just gonna be like, oh my God, trees and dogs.
Yeah. I was gonna read this poem of Jen's, which is my favorite poem of hers, which is called Una Dad. but it sort of speaks to like the tiny joys of in things. Which I think we're experiencing a bit more in the pandemic. And it's called Una Dad. This is my wife, Jay Hope Stein's poem. I write wall on the wall. I write bathroom on the bathroom door and cat on the wall above the litter bin. I write mirror on the mirror, so mirror appears across our faces. My three-year-old daughter Una cackles maniacally. Her joy of letters and language has started a compulsion in the house where we write everything on our walls and doors and windows. I write mom and dad on the bedroom door, and she draws a picture underneath. That's you on your wedding day. She draws a picture of herself on her bedroom door and writes her own name. On all the rest of the doors in the house, I write door, except the hallway closet where she insists on writing a double backwards H-I, so I-H-I-H. I write earth and star on the wall. On the refrigerator, I write food, book on the bookcase, bed on sink, sink on tub, tub on tub. On the wall near the toilet, my daughter writes hi. She draws a big rainbow on the hallway wall, and I write rainbow. She traces the letters with her fingers. She draws a sun on the wall, and I write sun. On the stairs, I write step. If you draw a tree on the window, I'll write tree, I tell her, and we do. If you draw a hippo, I'll write hippo, and we do. She draws a mean caterpillar mommy and a mean caterpillar baby on the wall, and I write mean caterpillar mommy and mean caterpillar baby. She draws a picture of our family and says, that's you in the lipstick. I have read some poetry in my life, but the most beautiful sentence I have ever seen in the English language is written by my three-year-old daughter Una in bright pink chalk on the sidewalk in front of my house. Una Dad. Una and Dad are one word, she explains, because Una and Dad love each other. And the two little lines above the word, as to offer accent or emphasis, it means they love each other. It's called Una Dad.
I loved your wife's poetry throughout the book. One thing I was going to ask you about it, which I don't know if you feel comfortable speaking for on this or not, but a lot of it is aquatic. She's a fish for
yes,
a bunch of it.
It is.
A lot of it is oceanic,
yeah.
Water.
Yeah, it is.
What is it about the experience that felt so aquatic?
Jen and I, this is before Una was born, and since she was born, we spend a lot of time at the Museum of Natural History. We're both fascinated by sea life, and every year since she was born, we go to the Museum of Natural History on her birthday every year. And this year, because of the pandemic, it was closed. We weren't able to go. And so in our apartment, we recreated the Museum of Natural History. And my wife actually sewed a big blue whale together out of felt and hung it from the ceiling like the whale at the Museum of Natural History. And yeah, it's just something that Jen muses over is sea life in her writing. And obviously, it has a lot of connection to birth and life and, you know, human beings and animals. It's just sort of a thematic through line that runs through the book.
How has being married to a poet changed your writing or relationship with language?
I mean, it just forces me to be better. I mean, you look at like someone like Mary Carr, who's one of my favorite authors, and she's also a poet. And I think that those two skills are quite interrelated, which is to say, I think she's a better prose writer because she is a poet. Because when you learn the economy of words of poetry, it starts to bleed into all your other forms of writing. And I feel that I've written two movies at this point, Sleepwalk With Me and Don't Think Twice. And in some ways, film is more like poetry than it is like prose. And I feel like that, you know, being married to a poet has made me a better writer. I think writing movies has made me a better writer. I think ultimately, economy of words is really a goal in prose. Like one of the things that's funny about the book is it's, as you were saying, you read in 4 hours. It's a quick read, but it is not for lack of more words I could have added. Like, it's intended to be that experience.
It's like the old Mark Twain line I would have written. I'm sorry, the letter. What is it? I'm sorry, my letter is so long. I would have been brief, but I ran out of time.
That's right. Yes.
Which I've always loved that as a commentary on language. I'll kind of finish us off on this language question, because something I always think about is in parenting is it's kind of changed my relationship to language, particularly in the way that it's made me mistrust it. I feel much better understood usually by my son, who can't understand most of the things I say, than I do by other people. And yes. I'm always surprised at how much can be communicated and then how much is actually getting lost or distorted, you know, even as precise a communicator as I am. And it's actually something that's shooken me a little bit. I'm much less sure now than I used to be that talking things out and trying to make yourself understood is actually operating at the right wavelength. There's something really surprising
about
that.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Ezra, but it sounds like you're hearing the world through baby's ears.
I'm going to end this podcast. I'm going to end it and not release it.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think that that's definitely something I completely relate to, is this idea of I've often find myself using my whole body and every word in my vocabulary or words that don't exist to try to convey to Una, you know, that we're about to eat macaroni and cheese.
But there's also just this funny way where, and I've said this I've talked about on the show before, but I feel like the reminder with a kid that a lot of what makes people act in different ways are their more animal needs. Mm-hmm. Maybe connect to your partner's poems and ideas about being a mammal. And you know, you'll be with your kid and it's like they're mad or upset or something. You start like running through this constant list of like, are they tired? Are they hungry? Do they need to get out of the house? Do they, you know, like, is the diaper full? Is the, sure. You know, it's very physical. And then yeah. It's like, as soon as people begin to be able to talk, I like lose that completely. Like, if you can tell me what's wrong, I will just trust that you are right about that and decide mm-hmm. about whether or not I agree, when oftentimes it's probably that you're tired.
Yeah, that's right.
And you see this in yourself too. Like, I'm often a jerk and I'm like, oh, I'm tired. Like, I am mad about things, but what's actually happening is I haven't slept.
I think that's right. And I think with the pandemic, I think that's particularly true, because we're all experiencing the same thing that you're describing, except times 10 or more, because there's so many restrictions on how we can remedy the issue, whether it's we're tired, we're angry, we're hungry, whatever the simple thing that we need is, it's not as solvable as quickly. And so to circle back to your earlier question of sort of like, how can we make sure that this isn't a lost year in our lives? It's, I think, possibly slowing down and acknowledging that some anger or something that we're upset about is simply a thought or a feeling and it'll pass, and that we don't need to solve it immediately.
I think that's a nice, wise place to end. So let me ask you, as always, a final question here, which is, what are three books you'd recommend?
I love Bess Kalb's book, which came out this year, Nobody Will Tell You This But Me, which is her
memoir. Yes, it is wonderful.
Yeah. It's a memoir of, I'm laughing as I say it because it's such a brilliant conceit. It's a memoir through the eyes of her grandmother that she wrote. And it's sort of somewhere between it's sort of creative nonfiction, and it's so funny. And I think they're adapting it into a movie, and they should. It's really wonderful. And then everything that Mary Carr and David Sedaris writes is perfect in my book. And the same with Zadie Smith. I think Zadie Smith has a book coming out of essays later this month, and the last one I read of hers was called Feel Free, which I highly recommend, and I can't wait to read her next one.
Michael Birbiglia, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Ezra. This is a real honor.
Thank you to Mike Barbiglia for being here. Thank you to all of you for being here, to Roche Karma for researching, to Jeffrey Geld for producing. The Ezra Klein Show is Vox Media podcast production.